Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. It has been 3 months since Cyclone Winston, the strongest cyclone to make landfall in the South Pacific in recorded history, tore through Fiji's main island, Viti Levu. The government's coordination of the local and international disaster response has been relatively well organized and well received by affected communities. But the sheer magnitude of the destruction has meant efforts to acquire the resources and materials to begin rebuilding continues to be slow. This is especially true for more than 300 families in Luvu settlement north of Latuka, which have yet to start rebuilding their homes. Pastor Mike Nauso of C3 Church, who ministers to the community, told Sally Brown the people he has spoken to are in high spirits despite the delays.
What is actually happening now? It's almost, it's almost back to normal with life, except for some of the houses that are still damaged and all that. Otherwise, when we talk to people, things seems to be going back to normal. It's quite a quick recovery.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Because, you know, they were very down when I visited, say, 6 weeks after the cyclone, and that was like 4 weeks ago. They were pretty down.
Yes. I think because of the frequent visit from the government side, things are beginning to take shape for them. Some have actually received some of the grants promised to them, which is a boost for them.
So these are the grants, the Help for Home initiative, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
So they've got this money to, they get hardware supplies, don't they, on a prepaid card?
What happened is they have to apply, and then each one of them are given a card, and they take this card across to the hardware departments to purchase their materials for building.
Okay, and so that has really helped a lot, has it? What sort of activity are you seeing around the building?
Right now, because there is so many people going for this, there's a lot of hardware departments that cannot actually meet the demand. So most of the orders are on hold. But, you know, they are happy knowing that something is coming across for them which is free.
So they're happy just to wait until those materials are available?
Yeah, because everybody came in to place their orders. Even me, I wanted to go and place some orders. I couldn't get anything at all.
So how long will they have to wait? How long will you have to wait?
Less than a month.
And what about people's mental state? Because when I visited a month ago, I could tell that people were really exhausted, tired, and almost, you know, really quite depressed about their circumstances. Has their mood changed?
Yes, things have changed a lot because what has happened is we've actually gone around, I think, twice now just to visit some of the families and talk to them about what has happened. And for most of them, things are almost back to normal. For them, they are good, which is a contributing factor is because the government is actually stepping in and they are trying to help as much as they can.
And what about for those people whose places were completely gone? Are they still living in tents?
Yes, the tents are still up. Like what I said, they're still waiting for the materials to come. For some of the houses that were completely destroyed, the government is going to build their house.
Oh, how do you mean they're going to build?
I don't know whether you've noticed when you came around the community, there were a few houses there that were government built by government. So the promise to these families that the government is going to actually build them a house, a proper house.
For free?
For free, yes.
And what, it'll be their house or will they pay rent for it?
It'll be their house. Few of the houses in the settlement was already built by the government. Those ones withstood the cyclone.
Okay, so they're just going to build more. Do you know how many more?
So far what I heard is about four houses, but it could be more.
So things looking good. What about the food situation? And many people, when I visited, you know, there wasn't enough work. They're informal workers, casual labourers, and they didn't have the work because after the cyclone, a lot of business had gone down. So are people finding jobs now?
Yes. Like what I said, things are back to normal. For some of them, they were casual laborers. They are going back now and doing the normal work. Plus, the food rations was, I can almost say it was in abundance. They were receiving it almost every second week. They were coming with food rations, and these food rations got everything. And for some of them, there's a lot of rations that they got that could last them a couple of months.
So they've got plenty of food?
They've got it, yes.
Are there any health issues?
No. The good thing about it, there was actually no outbreak of any sickness, which was really good. No major sickness in the community that we are in. There's really nothing major that happened in there.
Are you surprised that the recovery has been quite quick?
I am. We've been reaching out this community for over 7 years, and it's it's surprising to see what has taken place in a very short time.
Legislative drafting experts from across the Pacific met law enforcement officials in Auckland last week, that's in New Zealand, to revise the Pacific Island Forum's model provisions on combating terrorism financing and money laundering. The forum says the need to revise reflects the developments at the United Nations and with the international body devoted to stamping out money laundering and the financing of terror, the Financial Action Task Force said. Ben Robertson spoke to the forum's secretary, Nola Fasau.
In the early 2000s, following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, there was a strong call from the Pacific Islands Forum to respond to this in terms of national policies and laws and other strategies in place to combat terrorism in our region. So there was an urgent need for countries to put together strong legal measures to protect the region from these threats. And that model has been developed and adapted by many of the 14 Forum Island country members of the Pacific.
I suppose most people will be thinking, but there's no real threat of terrorism in the Pacific. Is it more about the financing of terrorism?
Yes, it is acknowledged that the threats are not as high, obviously, as other regions of the world, but the challenges posed to our region are quite unique. They are considered to be low, and this has been ongoing consideration of the Pacific Forum Regional Security Committee every year. But the importance is that every country remains vigilant to the risks that are posed by terrorist groups, particularly in terms of the financing areas, which is why the key revisions that were discussed this week related mainly to terrorist financing. For example, Vanuatu recently is on the grey list in terms of the FATF recommendations. So it's really updating the provisions to be in line with those recommendations, as well as in the area of foreign terrorist fighters. And there's also another area in terms of weapons of mass destruction. We had an expert from a UN committee who spoke to the meeting on this, and there was a recommendation to strengthen the provisions in these areas.
Is there actually money being laundered, being hidden in the Pacific, which is being used to support terrorism?
All I know is that it is an issue, as identified by the Forum Regional Security Committee. Money laundering continues to be one of the key crimes in the region, key transnational crimes.
In terms of money laundering, are Pacific foreign trusts targeted in these recommendations?
The focus was just largely on counterterrorism.
How much, though, do bank secrecy regulations stifle these recommendations?
That's dealt with more at a national level. That's why we weren't really sure how we were going to deal with the transnational crime issues.
Looking back at the 2002 provisions, how well were they implemented among forum members?
From reports by countries on Wednesday, there have been significant developments in recent years to update those provisions, but it became apparent throughout the discussions that, particularly in regard to the financing aspects, there still needs to be a lot of improvements in that area in particular. For example, in Samoa, they had a really good counterterrorism bill in about 2010, but it didn't align with the FATF recommendations. So it took a couple of more years before their act got enacted in 2014. But I think there were more issues that were identified this year and which countries did acknowledge would need to be further considered for their own national laws.
The Indonesian government denies suggestions that it is not open to communication regarding West Papua. This follows criticisms from the Melanesian government that Indonesia has rebuffed requests to dialogue over concerns about rights abuses in Papua. Atelemi Jiria Samarukid is the special assistant to Indonesia's coordinating minister of politics, legal and security, Luta Parebitan. He spoke to Johnny Blades.
We like to have a good relationship with those countries, but we stated also that the problem of West Papua or Papua is our own problem. We don't want to compromise our sovereignty on Papua. This is clearly stated during our visit to this country in the Southern Pacific.
Do you recognize that some of these neighboring countries have concerns about their fellow Melanesians, so they are raising issues because they're concerned? Is it not okay to talk about it?
Yes, that's why we understand that communication and open communication between those countries with Indonesia is very important. Because we found that most of the information they receive is partly wrong or 100% wrong. So based on that, we extend our communication to those countries so they get the latest open information about what really happens in Papua. Like, give an example, almost 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting in our office here to settle down human rights problem in Papua. And we invite the ambassador from Papua New Guinea, from Fiji and Vanuatu to also present at their meeting so they can fully watch and hear what really happens and how we solve our problem openly.
Will this be followed by concrete action to make sure that perpetrators of rights abuses are held accountable?
Sure, yes, yes. It takes maybe 1-2 months to prepare all what we call the holistic approach to the people in Papua. So now we like to concentrate development to such area where the people, the local people there can develop themselves. So it's more proactive, giving opportunity to them to work with the money from the central government.
The Papuans, they worry about things like transmigration because, of course, it seems to make them the minority in Papua and it doesn't favour them at all. So why is transmigration still happening?
My understanding that the transmigration program has been stopped since 2 years ago. We are not continuing those programs that belongs to the past government, the previous government.
But this is not what we see. The boats are still coming.
No, it's not transmigration. It's people coming there from other people like to find an opportunity. But there's no formal transmigration program. There's no money, no people sent formally, I mean, by the government, like in the past.
A West Papuan theologian and activist says Papuan nationalist aspirations are a direct consequence of how the Indonesian state has treated his people. Reverend Dr. Benny Glay says West Papuans don't feel part of the Indonesian society due to the state policy towards them since the former Dutch New Guinea was incorporated into the Republic in the 1960s. He told Don Wiseman that when he looks back over 5 decades under Indonesian rule, there is no progress in the situation.
Even early 1960s, the Indonesian government started to position us Papuans as a backward, primitive, uncivilized, and that by after making that claim, they positioned themselves as a civilized nation who come to help us, to make us equal to other Indonesians. And thirdly, after they claim that the position as a civilized, superior nation, they formulate their own development policies, ideologies. And that in the long run became an ideology that marginalizes us, Papuans. they still have that view up until now.
As it is now, what does it mean for Papuans after effectively, as you say, 50 years of being treated badly?
Papua, by making that claim or by taking that position toward us Papuans, they systematically at least excluded us Papuans socially and culturally, to the point that we become object of exploitation, object of stigmatization. So we Papuans feel that we are not part of Indonesian modern society. We have not been treated that way. And I think in the 50 years history of interaction with Indonesians, that process gave birth to Papuan nationalism. As a church leader, when we met Indonesian President SBY on 16th of December 2011, we told him that what you Indonesians call separatists, from the point of view of history, we call it Papuan nationalism. That is what Papuans think collectively up until now.
Alex Rina, who heads the Papua New Guinea Media Council, is the executive editor of the Port Courier newspaper. And he says there are signs showing that poverty is soaring on the streets of the capital. Mr. Rina says that while the country has been enjoying a dramatic period of growth over the past 10 years, the reverses since the fall of commodity prices and the drop-off of construction have led to a telling effect. He told Don Wiseman there appears to be many more homeless in the streets.
There have been pictures posted on social media of kids, you know, sleeping in front of the shops. I think one of the interventions that the government did, I think the last time when it sort of seriously decided to address the issue of poverty on the streets of Port Moresby was just a month away from the Pacific Games last year, when it decided that the kids will be taken in by various NGO partners and looked after for the duration of the games. And unfortunately, just 6 to 8 months on from the games, there seems to be an indication of more homeless kids on the streets.
There have always been significant numbers of homeless in Port Moresby, though, haven't there?
Yes, it's always been there, but you have to basically put those indicators against a decade or so of positive economic growth and windfall revenue that's come into PNG government coffers over the last 10 to 14 years from high global commodity prices, LNG exports and all that.
So those at the bottom of the rung haven't benefited in any way?
No, I think the challenge for the government over the last 10 years or so, and this includes the Somare government as well, is how do you translate those windfall revenue into tangible development that trickles right down to the ordinary Papua New Guinean living here in the Port Moresby settlements, for example. How do you give opportunities for Papua New Guineans who live not at Toguba Hill, which is where most of the elite of Port Moresby and the affluent live, but in Papua New Guineans living in suburbs like Gerehu or Waigani? How do they get to benefit from the opportunities that come with positive economic growth? And that has always been a challenge for the Somare government and now the O'Neill government.
Is much effort actually going into it?
Yes, I think, you know, all the construction that was connected to the construction phase of the PNG LNG project, and then the South Pacific Games, you know, infrastructure, there was a lot of employment. There were a lot of Papua New Guineans who basically benefited from the big government investment in infrastructure for the Pacific Games. Unfortunately, now with the downturn in the global economy and the revenue that the government's getting from the exports of minerals, well, it's dwindled. So there are a lot of Papua New Guineans now who are out of jobs and who are struggling to actually make ends meet. And we are seeing that manifest itself in the number of kids who are out at traffic lights in Port Moresby begging. But on another thing, you actually get to see a lot of the kids who are actually walking to school themselves. Very, very young kids, as young as 6 or 7, who would normally be accompanied by a parent. And it makes you ask questions whether the kid is actually walking to school, because most probably the mom or dad is actually selling ice blocks or selling cigarettes or betel nut to try and make ends meet. So consequently, the whole challenge relating to poverty is actually having an impact on the kids as well, and their own security, because, you know, Port Moresby has its own challenges in terms of law and order and violence against children. It's quite high in PNG as well.
One of the things about the Pacific is that there has always been enough food for people. But I think you've suggested that there are issues with food now.
That would definitely be an issue. Looking at the number of Papua New Guineans who were previously employed when there was a construction boom in Port Moresby and who are now out of the job because there are no more employment opportunities in the construction industry. Definitely it will have a ripple effect on families and their ability to put food on the table for their kids.
It's 400 years since Tonga has had its first contact with European explorers. In 1616, an expedition led by two explorers from the Netherlands, William Schouten and Jacob de Meer, came across the Nelsis while they were trying to find an alternative route to Indonesia. Makirilakam Akirisigangi, an academic from New Zealand's Massey University, says the explorers only started 4 days, in which time they managed to both trade and fight with locals. He was in Tonga to mark the event with the Dutch ambassador to New Zealand, Rob Zeeman, who told Jemmy Tahanaha that despite the brief visit, they left a lasting legacy.
Well, William Schouten was the captain of the ship, and Jacob de Meer was there as a kind of a commercial enterpriser. His father, Isaac de Meer, and a number of merchants from Amsterdam had funded the expedition. De Meer Senior and the merchants had formed this company in competition with the Dutch East India Company, you see, because they had the monopoly on the spice trade and also the trading routes, so, interestingly enough. So the expedition was actually sent to try and find an alternative route around South America. So they left Holland in June 1615, and then they came upon the Tuamotu Archipelago, which is in Tahiti. Then they reached Tonga on the 9th of May 1616. They stayed there for about 4 days. They didn't actually land. I mean, they didn't actually step on Tongan soil, but they did trade with the locals, and also there were a bit of problem with, as is the case, with sort of misunderstandings and so on and so forth.
Was there any intention of discovering Tonga or setting foot on there? Because this was the first European encounter for Tonga, wasn't
it? It was the very first European encounter. I don't think that they had intention to actually land. These are the northern islands of Tonga, which is Niue. And I think they were just sailing westward, and it just so happened that they came upon the Tongan Islands. But yeah, so it was a very first encounter, obviously. And of course, the next encounter with the European explorer was Abel Tasman, who came to Tonga in 1643. So it was just 27 years after Schouten and de Meer that Tasman came along. Of course, Tasman landed and stayed in Tonga for some time. But these guys was very interesting because obviously they came with some conceptions from Europe as to the so-called natives and how they lived and so forth. And of course the Tongans themselves also had conceptions themselves about foreign visitors. So they weren't passive actors. Schouten and de Meer, they didn't understand a lot of the things that happened or the things that took place. But they did write down everything that they saw, you know, even the things that they didn't understand. And then through that, I was able to sort of get a glimpse of the political and social setup in Tonga at that time.
And what was a Tongan's perspective? Just the thought of imagining, you know, being on an island and setting this giant European ship turns up with white people on board. How was that recorded from the Tongan perspective?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly enough, at that time, Tonga was going through a political upheaval itself. Traditionally, Tonga has three kingly dynasties. The third dynasty is the present dynasty in Tonga at the moment. And so that dynasty had just been established just before Schouten and de Meer came to Tongan waters. And so, you know, things were not quite settled, not quite established. And so they came onto that. And I think at the time, Tongan society was somewhat in disarray, you know, because of the new dynasty. The dynasty, of course, was established from Tongatapu, which is several hundred kilometers away, and would have been difficult to gauge the influence of the new dynasty at the Niues, where Schouten and de Meer visited. Actually, at the time, the Niues were somewhat semi-independent from the center of power in Tongatapu. And the king of Niue, Latu Mailangi, who actually received the Dutch explorers, some say was an independent king, which is, well, it wasn't how things were prior to this. But another angle was that the Niues had been given the right by a previous king to resist foreign visitors to their shores. Now, I don't know whether this extended to white foreign visitors, but the way that the Nieuwers had tried to resist and attack the Dutch explorers actually reflected this independence on their part. The other interesting thing was that the encounter actually has been memorialized and remembered through the creation of Tongan family names. You know, there's a name called Wakata. Waka is boat and ta is to hit. So Wakata is to hit the boat. And also the name Tauwaka is one of the people who was injured by the Dutch when the Tongans tried to attack the boat.
Yeah, so it was quite a fraught encounter.
It was, I think, and it's mainly because the Europeans came with, you know, with their own way, their own perceptions about what they hoped to find. And, you know, for example, on the 9th, they encountered this canoe, which was sailing apparently towards Samoa. And they had fired a couple of shots across the bow, you know, in marine protocol. That means that they want you to stop. Of course, the Tongans had no idea. They didn't stop, of course, and they kept on moving northward. And there was a skirmish, and some people were injured. And I think had they stayed a little bit longer, I suppose they would have been able to try to get to understand each other from both sides. But as it was, they sailed from Niotoktapu and Tafaki towards Niofo'o, and they were actually attacked there as well. So it seemed like the Tongans were not overawed by, you know, by these, as you said, you know, by these great big boats and people who actually had guns and so on. They saw themselves as being the equal of the Dutch, or in fact, even probably a bit superior.
And with that, we conclude this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this edition of the program again, as well as past editions, by visiting the website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com, and click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.